This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, starring Ralph Fiennes, is now available on demand. The Congress, starring Robin Wright as an actress offered the chance to perform forever as a digital avatar at the expense of her real career, is available now on demand before it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, which is such an important and vivid part of this podcast, it's basically like a third co-host. This is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. This week on the show, love and hilarious cliches about love are both in the air as we review David Wayne's new romantic comedy satire, They Came Together.
Later in the show, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme and inspired by They Came Together. We were going to do just straight romantic comedies, but after They Came Together, we both found it impossible to take any of them seriously anymore, to watch them without seeing the cliches. So instead, we're not going to take anything seriously on this podcast, and we are instead going to recommend some other satires and spoofs that are available to rent or stream right now. And along the way, I promise to mangle the Star Spangled Banner and save the Queen of England from Reggie Jackson. Take that one to the bank. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films that are new on demand this week. Allison, what are our picks?
Well, first off is a film that I was a huge fan of, as were many other people, and happy to see it available now on demand. It is Snowpiercer, the first English language film, or mostly English language film, from director Bong Joon-ho, who is a Korean director who's done some great things, including The Host, most famously, which was, I think, the number one film in the Korean box office of all time, and also became kind of a breakout internationally as well. But Snowpiercer is an international production starring Chris Evans, Song Kang-ho, and Tilda Swinton, among others. And it is set on a train in a kind of post-apocalyptic planet where everything has been, like, most life has been extinguished in a new ice age. The only humans who are left are on this train, which is constantly circling the globe. And it has to keep moving in order to keep everyone alive. And on this train, there is a class rebellion and revolution in which Chris Evans leads the people from the back of the train who have been living in terrible conditions and eating protein goo bars and, you know, also look very grimy.
Looks like Soylent Black.
Yes.
But jello-y.
And they live in like stacked bunk bed things. There's no windows. And they decide to rebel, and they're going to make their way towards the front of the train where all the rich people live. And they're going to take the engine and, you know, make life better for everyone in this tiny, you know, railway arc that is the last remnants of humanity, that holds the last remnants of humanity.
One, two, three, one, two.
Up at you, Katarina Bridge, you filthy ingrates!
You people! Who would I not for the benevolent Wilfred would have frozen solid 18 years ago today? You people who have suckled the generous titty of Wilfred ever since for food and shelter. And now, in front of our hallowed water supply section, no less. You repay his kindness with violent hooliganism. You scum. Precisely 74% of you shall die.
From this really crazy premise comes both a really solid action film and the sort of sci-fi film that I think you would put somewhere between Brazil and The Matrix. It is the sort of film in which it lends itself to some great social commentary about the class system and about capitalism, and also some great fight scenes involving axes and crossing a strategic bridge. It's funny and dramatically, you know, very interesting as well. Some great performances. Chris Evans, you know, when he's not, he plays a very good superhero, but he's also very good when he's not. Particular standout, though, I would say, is Tilda Swinton, who plays basically sci-fi Maggie Thatcher. Yeah. And she is amazingly repellent and monstrous and wonderful.
And lovable.
Yeah, she's really terrific.
Yep.
This has been a very good year for Tilda Swinton, and this is one of many great roles she's had. So that is Snowpiercer, available now on demand. If you've been reading about it and it wasn't in a theater near you, here's your chance. And it is definitely worth watching.
Yeah, I second that recommendation. Really, really good film. Doesn't really make a ton of sense. Like,
right.
Don't focus on the details of the train.
Right. Like, I don't think... It works better as a big metaphor.
That's what I was going to say, exactly. That it really only works as a metaphor for the 1% and the 99% and all those sorts of things. So, but the reason it's easy to not focus on those metaphors, like as you said, it's just an awesome action movie. It has all these great set pieces, this weird world. We love exploring the train along with the people coming from the back. And
it stretches that kind of the established fictional reality more and more as it goes along anyway.
Yeah.
Like it starts off maybe with a sense of grittiness and then becomes weirder and weirder.
More surreal as it goes along.
Yeah.
And really brilliantly cast. You mentioned a couple of actors, but there's even more. There's some surprises that I thought were very effective. So yeah, definitely one of the best movies of the year so far. So check it out.
Yeah. Next up are two films I haven't had a chance to see yet, but I'm really looking forward to, and they're both going to be available on demand on August 1st. The first one is The Calling, which is directed by, I believe it's Jason Stone's first film. He is a writer-producer who, among other things, worked on This is the End. So he is not making a kind of Seth Rogen-ish film. Instead, for his first film, he has made a thriller. This is a description. Detective Hazel Micheleff hasn't had much to worry about in the sleepy town of Port Dundas until a string of gruesome murders brings her face-to-face with a serial killer. Standard sounding stuff, but it stars Susan Sarandon, which is, you know, one, quite an actress to land in your film. And also, as much as Susan Sarandon's been showing up a lot on screen lately and often in these comedic roles, which has been very fun to see, she hasn't had a lead role in a while, at least not one that I can remember. So, you know, this is her stepping back into the lead, and that's something I'm looking forward to. Also stars Topher Grace, hoping as the serial killer, but who knows? You can never tell with Topher Grace. So that is The Calling. And also available on August 1st is The One I Love, which is directed by Charlie McDowell. It is about a married couple played by Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men, who find their relationship and very existence put to the test in this wickedly inventive romantic comedy per the description per Movies on Demand. I've heard a lot about this one, but have managed to avoid getting spoiled on the premise, which apparently starts off like a seemingly typical relationship drama about a couple who, you know, are seeing a therapist or trying to figure out if they can save their marriage. And then apparently has a sci-fi element, which is very interesting and actually makes it very appealing to me because I do love a good sci-fi romantic comedy or sci-fi relationship drama. So, and, you know, I certainly like Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass as well, who's usually very willing to take on interesting smaller projects, especially ones that he has not written and directed himself. He's very game to try out new things. So I think the idea that this has a twist is very appealing to me. That's The One I Love, and it is available on demand on August 1st.
you're living in a bubble and you haven't got a care. Well, you're gonna be in trouble, cause we're gonna steal your air. Cause what you got is what we need, and all we do is dirty deeds. We're the Spaceballs. Watch out, we're the Spaceballs. We're the masters of space.
Hey, don't mess around
with the Spaceballs.
Interesting to talk about spoof films in that the type of spoof film that David Wayne has made, They Came Together, which we'll talk about later, isn't the type of spoof film that tends to get made most frequently these days. Most frequently these days are ones like Epic Movie or all of those, I can't remember the name of those two directors.
Friedberg and Seltzer.
There you go.
It's not that you can't remember. You have worked very hard to forget them, and you succeeded until I reminded you.
I'm
watching as your mind is... It's all flooding back, that horrible experience you had watching Meet the Spartans.
Oh,
she's
God.
Bursting into tears before my eyes, listeners. She's breaking down.
Why did you have to remind me?
She's bursting into tears. She's covering her face with her hands.
I've been so happy having forgotten.
I know. Sorry. Yes. Friedberg and Seltzer. Yes. And their style of spoof. Well, I guess you could sum it up in one word as unfunny, but the other way to describe it is that they really focus on just topical references. You know, hey, look, it's a 300, but there's Michael Jackson, right. Or, you know, like,
remember this movie? Remember this one?
Right.
This one was in theaters a few months ago.
Right. Hey, remember that movie 10,000 BC? Well, what if Britney Spears was in it? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
A lot of that.
So, you know, these movies, which have been very successful for them, I mean, in terms of like how quickly they've been able to turn them around, how relatively cheaply they've been able to make them. It's unfortunate, though, that has become what the spoof has come to mean in the last decade, let's say.
I think what you're trying to say here is that the spoof has fallen on hard times.
Yes.
And that it is if it was ever a reputable genre, which I don't know that it was, it's
no.
Now a particularly disreputable one. And that it is considered, I think, by many, the lowest of the low. You know, it was always lowbrow. But I think there was a bit of high art in that lowbrow back in the day when it was being performed by the likes of some of the filmmakers we're going to talk about during our picks. But that it has generally it's seen better days, let's say. And I think one of the things that's nice about They Came Together, without spoiling it, is that it's a good spoof. And it's nice to see those because we really don't get to see them very often. Although, I think we've managed to pick, with our picks, I was going to say two of, but really it might just be the only two, besides They Came Together, ignoring They Came Together. The only two spoofs that are worth watching of maybe the last
decade, I would say.
There are there's one or two that aren't terrible amongst the group of blank movies,
yes,
known by Friedberg and Seltzer.
Okay.
But at a certain point, the Zuckers, who we're going to talk about a lot, I might as well just spoil it right there. Of course, they're one of the names you think of. David Zucker, Jerry Zucker, Jim Abrams. Some of the Zuckers, and I'll look up to see exactly who, but they made, or at least produced, and I think had a hand in writing, Superhero Movie, which came out probably 2000. Well, I'll look this up in a bit, but not bad. Has some funny moments. I saw that in the theater, don't judge. And it was pretty funny. Kind of funny. And then they also worked on, after the first couple of Scary Movies, which were more Wayans Brothers,
right,
another name in spoofery, they made Don't Be a Menace and they made I'm Gonna Get You Sucka, which are both funny. They kind of handed the franchise off to the Zuckers, and they made Scary Movie 3 and 4, and I think they might have been mildly involved in 5. 3 and 4 are actually kind of funny.
Yeah. I'm amazed that you've seen this
movie. Yeah. I like spoofs. I guess we should get that out there. I mean, I grew up on the classics, you know?
Yes.
The movies that we all really love that are spoofs. You know, the Blazing Saddles of the world, the Airplanes of the world, the Naked Guns. I mean, the Naked Gun is really one of my all-time favorite comedies. Blazing Saddles, too. Both of those I would put up there as two of my very, very favorite. Definitely would be in, like, you know, my top 5 comedies. I love that. And I love this style of lowbrow but high laugh ratio comedy. I love a silly, silly movie. And so I've kind of hung in with the genre as hard as I could, even amongst the dreck.
I'm very impressed, actually, because there have been some just horrible, things that challenge the basic definition of a movie, I think.
Or a comedy, for that matter. Yeah. No, most of them are pretty terrible. But there have been a couple of decent ones. But yeah, let me run down very quickly, because we decided, even though we are going to talk about Mel Brooks and the Zuckers, you kind of have to do that, we are going to try to pick some of their less famous titles. So just very quickly, some of the more famous ones that they've made that are on Netflix: Airplane and Naked Gun, both available streaming on Netflix right now. Mel Brooks' Robin Hood Men in Tights, not one of his greatest films, but still funny, is on Netflix. And then some other ones that we're not going to talk about. Not Another Teen Movie is on Netflix. I don't know that I would watch it, but it's there if you're interested. Casa de Mi Padre, which was the Will Ferrell kind of a spoof of, you know, Spanish language, very over the top melodramas. I didn't love it. Did you ever see it, Allison?
I never got to see it. No.
Yeah. Josh Larson, co-host of Film Spotting Original Recipe, is a huge fan of Casa de Mi Padre. So it has its partisans, and I love Will Ferrell. That one, I just didn't quite get the joke. I didn't think the joke worked.
Yeah, I feel like the people who made that, who also made a IFC miniseries,
The Spoils of Babylon.
Yes, that their sense of humor verges on, it's between spoof and just that they really want to make a movie that is like actually a pretty accurate like recreation.
And that's the thing. Casa de Mi Padre was so deadpan at times that there was almost no jokes. You know, the only joke was the fact that it was Will Ferrell starring in a Spanish language melodrama. That was the entire joke. And there weren't a lot of quote unquote jokes. And I like a spoof with a lot of jokes. So maybe that just wasn't to my taste. However, it is available on Netflix. You might want to check it out. Scary Movies 2 and 3. And as I said, number 3 is one of the not terrible ones, both on Netflix. And then the two spy movies that were by Jean Dujardin and Michael Hazanavicius,
yes,
the
OSS
artist team, the OSS
117.
Yeah, those are both on streaming on Netflix and I think on Hulu as well.
Yeah, certainly Cairo Nest of Spies, which I think is the second one, maybe? Or maybe the first one, is on Hulu now for free. So you can check that out. I have not seen either, but I feel like, you know, obviously that union worked out well for them.
Absolutely. So Superhero Movie came out in 2008. So it is within this decade. Craig Mazin was the writer-director. I thought the Zuckers were involved somehow. I'm going to check really quickly here and see if I can find if they were producers. They were producers. David Zucker, at least, was a producer on that one. So yeah, that one's not bad either. That one's not available for streaming at the moment, but you could probably rent it somewhere. All right, let's get to our picks. Allison, why don't you go first? Because I've been yakking on here.
All right.
What's your first pick?
My first pick is from one of those people that you have to talk about when you talk about spoofs. Mel Brooks, who really, I think, is, you know, the genius, in terms of, like, spoofing genres, he is, like, the genius who... I mean, I'm not going to talk about one of his, like, all-time classics. Though Blazing Saddles, I would say, is my personal favorite of those.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
But talk about one that is very respected, but a little less known, which is High Anxiety, which is currently streaming on Netflix. I think the reason that it is not maybe on the level as, say, a Young Frankenstein or Blazing Saddles is, in an interesting way, it's almost like too fond and too respectful of what it's spoofing, which is Hitchcock thrillers. And this is from 1977. Hitchcock was still alive at the time. You know, this is in a way that some of those other films weren't. It's very much a contemporary spoof. You know, these are films that came out in the last, like a lot of these were in the last decade or two when he was making them. Hitchcock, you know, was at the end of his career. He passed away in 1980. And though he's not credited as a writer on the films, Brooks has said in an interview with NPR that Hitchcock worked with him on the script, that they would do 45 minutes a week on Fridays.
Wow.
He would come in, they would do 45 minutes, and then they would have lunch.
Huh.
And apparently the joke in which there's a scene that's basically The Birds, in which Mel Brooks'
that's
character
one of the best scenes.
Yes, is sitting and the birds gather and he gets basically...
Well, don't spoil it.
Yes.
Don't spoil it.
He gets attacked in a certain
way.
Yes,
I think that's good.
That was Hitchcock's idea. So
it makes it that much funnier that particular joke, which is very lowbrow.
Yes.
And very tasteless, was Hitchcock's. That makes it that much better.
I know. And so so High Anxiety is less, say, joke dense than something like Young Frankenstein, but it's funny in a really film dork way that I really enjoy, which it has things like dolly shots that close in on outside a room and then break the window, you know, like that it's zooming in onto people who are sitting behind a window talking and it breaks the window.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like Mel Brooks's character is in a car and he's set and they're having a conversation and something dramatic happens and the music kicks in, the dramatic music kicks in, and then the camera turns to outside and there's like a bus passing them in the other lane that's carrying a full orchestra who are playing the dramatic music. And there are just jokes like that all the time, and actually fairly accurate recreations of just kind of Hitchcock-like framing that is really impressive. Then you have Madeline Kahn doing a funny and very unflattering Kim Novak impression, and Brooks playing things maybe as straight as I've ever seen him, as Richard H. Thorndike, a psychiatrist who suffers from high anxiety and who's just taken a new job at an institute for the very, very nervous, which seems to have some nefarious doings.
Tell me, Mr. Cartwright, do you know why you're here at the institute?
Yes, I was brought in 2 years ago. I was suffering from nervous exhaustion. I used to get sharp pains in my neck and dreamt about werewolves.
Werewolves?
Werewolves.
And in the 2 years that you've been here, you feel you've made any progress?
Oh, I never get those pains anymore. And it's been 6 months since I had a dream about a werewolf.
6 months since you had your last dream about a werewolf. Tell me, Mr. Cartwright, frankly, if you were returned to the community today, do you think you could function in a happy, healthy, normal, and productive manner?
Oh, I think so. I feel pretty good.
Plot, not important. This is one that, if you're a Hitchcock fan, it offers all kinds of great moments and little rewards that you'll recognize. And it's Mel Brooks. It's always funny. Even when it's not Mel Brooks at his all-time greatest, he's still so good. And this one is certainly pretty solid Mel Brooks. So that is High Anxiety, which is currently streaming on Netflix.
Yeah, I think one of the things that might hold it back a little bit, and you, I think, alluded to this, is that idea that Hitchcock's movies aren't, although I guess some of the things in them have now become cliches. We don't think of them as these cheesy or terrible or cliched movies. They're actually, you know, masterpieces. So his raw materials are a little better, actually, than what Mel Brooks would usually work with. And I think that perhaps that maybe is part of why it's just not quite as great as some of those other ones, is because
it's hard to poke fun of something that's so good.
Right. I mean, you can make it almost at times verges on one of those Friedberg and Seltzer's where you're sort of just making references to, like, hey, look, this is Psycho. Hey, look, this is, you know, this is The Birds. And so the cliches aren't as plentiful as they are in something like an Airplane, where you're making fun of disaster movies,
right,
which are mostly pretty terrible.
Yes, agreed. That's a good point.
Okay, my first pick, and again, we're going with one of the giants, the Mount Rushmore of spoofdom, I guess. I guess the Mount Rushmore might just be Mel Brooks and these three guys, maybe, when you come right down to it, David Zucker, Jerry Zucker, and Jim Abrams. And I'm going to go with one of their, again, lesser known but still hilariously funny movies, and that is Top Secret! Exclamation point, from 1984, which is streaming now on Netflix. And the Zuckers, most of their movies are spoofs of a specific genre. Airplane is a spoof of disaster movies. The Naked Gun is a spoof of cop movies. The interesting thing about Top Secret, but again, what possibly makes it not quite as successful, at least in my eyes. Some people think it's their funniest movie. I happen to think...
I do really like it.
I love it too, but I happen to think I would still put it behind...
Airplane, certainly.
And The Naked Gun.
Yes.
Is the fact that it's actually a spoof of two different genres. They kind of combine them. It's a spoof of spy films, Cold War spy films, and also Elvis Presley movies, which Elvis Presley, to my knowledge, never made a spy film. But this is almost an imagination of, like, what would that have looked like if it also had a lot of silly jokes in it. So Val Kilmer, of all people, stars as Nick Rivers, who is the Elvis figure in this film. And he is sent to East Germany. He's going to perform at this, I don't know, it's like a culture festival or something. But inevitably, he becomes involved in this, like, underground spy ring and gets dragged into this French, movement, and silliness ensues. I mean, the plot is not hugely important, which I suppose is another aspect of spoofs, I guess. The plot is never all that important, although sometimes in the best ones, you at least come to care about the characters. And this one has, again, great sequences, great gags. There's an amazing sequence that immediately comes to mind anytime I think of this movie that involves the entire thing is backwards. They shot it in one direction and then reversed it. So in the film, it's played entirely in reverse. Uh-huh. And it takes a minute to realize because it just seems like something's off here. And then you realize, and then they have some fun with it. And it's kind of genius. And there's some great songs because it is a sort of a musical because you have this Elvis Presley figure. The opening theme, the opening titles are to a song, Skeet Surfing, which is sort of a parody of Beach Boys songs, but also involves shooting, you know, skeet shooting. You see him shooting and surfing near the Malibu. And waves to blast their pigeons. And it's so neat shooting ski while you're riding on the heavies all day. First wave, don't get tired. Second wave, pull it tight. Third wave, pull it tight. It's surfing all night. We're waxing down. How Silly Can You Get is another popular Nick Rivers hit. And that's sort of, I guess that's the Zucker Brothers, it's on the Zucker Brothers family crest, I suppose, that phrase, how silly can you get? And the answer is very, very, very silly. It's a great film. Again, I don't think it's one of their very best, but I could watch this movie every day of my life and find new things to laugh at. I was watching the beginning of it just before we started and laughing all over again. The opening scenes involve Omar Sharif. As a spy, and of course that's another great Zucker Brothers hallmark, is finding serious actors and having them kind of poke fun at themselves. So Omar Sharif, not known for his funny bone, but doing a very good job in the film. And then right after the scene with him, there's this scene in this giant East German stronghold. Everyone is talking like they're Nazis. They almost seems like the World War II hasn't ended in this movie. And someone brings in like a telegram, and it says, you know, British spy escapes. Is still last seen on the, you know, the British Express or a train or whatever. And the East German who reads it, looks at it and then takes out his rubber stamp and stamps it, find him and kill him, which is just like, it's just great. So it's top secret. It is streaming now on Netflix. It is funny. That is my review in three words. It is funny.
All right. Well, my next pick is a more recent film. From 2007, so it is one of those two with maybe some other exceptions from the last decade that is pretty solid. And it is Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, which is available for rent on Google Play, iTunes, and YouTube. This is written and produced by Judd Apatow and Jake Kasdan, who also directed the film, and stars John C. Reilly as Dewey Cox, who, you know, arises from poverty and a terrible childhood involving a machete accident and a father who continually tells him wrong kid died and goes on to music stardom and multiple rises and falls and two wives, many children, several hits throughout the ages from country to disco, and a kind of flirtation in the 60s with psychedelia. And this film is, I mean, it's closest to, and, you know, obviously the title is a reference to Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic that had come out like 2 years before. And I think one of the things that attests to the fact that Walk Hard is a good spoof beyond that is just that as we get further and further away from Walk the Line, and I barely remember the beats of that, Walk Hard works because it's also about biopics, musical right. biopics, and how kind of inherently funny it is to just mush someone's story into this arc and to kind of attach, you know, this particular, you know, plot line to it and then always find this uplifting ending. It's not spoiler, like after the movie ends and there's this title card, it's like Dewey Cox died 3 minutes after this performance, which is like the best, like after he'd figured everything out, and that people's lives are ever so convenient. And along with that, it manages to point out ways in which all of these biopics do ridiculous things, including the way that Dewey Cox's life involves intersecting with all of these different celebrities, some of whom play themselves, especially once we get into the 70s and, you know, and 80s, some of whom are played by other people. This is the movie that gave us Justin Long's uncannily good George Harrison impersonation when Dewey Cox goes to India and meets the Beatles. But that it also has, you know, Jenna Fischer is in it, and I think is very funny as like the woman who ultimately Dewey Cox falls in love with. But Kristen Wiig is great as the high school girl Dewey Cox marries, who like says, you know, I promise you only to unconditionally support you, love you and support your dreams. And then in the next scene is being like, you'll never make it, Dewey. Why can't you just grow up? And basically spends the rest of the movie playing the like worst version of the scolding harpy wife, who is in so many biopics. It is like such a thankless role to end up in a biopic, but she plays into it really well. It's very funny. And John C. Reilly is I mean, he's great when he's doing comedy and great when he's doing drama, but this is particularly good in terms of the ways he's able to, he's not deadpan. I think like what he's able to do, I think, is have this amazing innocence in that there's this recurring theme in which he keeps running into one of his bandmates who's doing some form of escalating drug. And the bandmate always says, go away, Dewey. You don't want any of this. And then he, of course, does want some of that. And the way in which John C. Reilly is like surprised every time is like, what are you doing? And it's marijuana, and then it's pills, and then it's so on. I think is a test to his particular comedic timing and what makes this work so well.
Come on, Dewey, join the party.
No, Dewey, you don't want this. Get out of here.
You know what? I don't want no hangover. I can't get no hangover.
It doesn't give you a hangover.
Well, I get addicted to it or something?
It's not habit forming.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't want to overdose on it.
You can't OD on it.
It's not going to make me want to have sex, is it?
It makes sex even better.
Sounds kind of expensive.
It's the cheapest drug there is.
Hmm.
You don't want it.
I think I kind of want it.
Okay, but just this once. Come on in.
It's a little over long, I will give you that. I think it's almost 2 hours long, and there are certainly parts where you feel like it could pick up the pace, but it does also cover, you know, decades of this fictional musician's life. And I think the fact that it's so funny still at this point, almost a decade away from Walk the Line, the original thing it was skewering, means that it's working as a spoof. It's very funny. And also, you mentioned a few good songs. This one has a few good songs as well.
Yes.
Walk Hard, the song that is, you know, his signature song, but also has a really good one, Let's Duet.
Yes, that's
the,
a great song.
The one with Jenna Fischer's character, mm-hmm. in which they basically just exchange very dirty innuendos,
yes.
and in the form of an innocent country song,
yes.
is very good. So that is Walk the Line. It is available for rent on Google Play, iTunes, YouTube, and probably some other places as well.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'd say that is the best spoof of the last 10, 15, 20 years. I think it's great. I don't think it's too long. I think it could be longer. I would watch a miniseries. I would watch a sequel. I would watch car commercials starring Dewey Cox. Anything John C. Reilly wants to do as that character, I would be interested in seeing it. I think it's very, very funny. And, you know, there's a case where we had a genre that was really just begging to be mocked, the biopic.
Yes.
I mean, there are such horrible cliches in these movies.
Even some of them that are
not terrible, they're just became so quickly, it just became such a cliched thing, and such the arc of these movies became so repetitive.
I know. Well, even that, like, Dewey Cox has got to think about his whole entire life before he goes on stage.
The flashback,
like that, he goes to find him, and he's standing against the wall, like, in silhouette, and that leads to the flashback that is the entire film.
And the fact that in so many of these movies, they have the one actor, partly to show their range as an actor, the one actor plays them from the time they're, like, usually it's, like, from, like, 21 till they're, like, 60, but in this movie,
he's 14.
He's like 14, which is like such a great joke because he is playing it so young, and it's just great. John C. Reilly is my hero. So yeah, that's it. If you hadn't recommended that one, I definitely would have recommended
one. Well,
so
I'm glad we got it out there.
Yes, I am too. So my other pick is the other, I think, kind of standout from the spoofs of recent years It's not as good as Wild Card, but it is good. I was just rewatching it again and going, this has a, not only is it funny, I think it has a certain amount of purity. You know, I think that there's something to a spoof that needs to resemble what it is. You know, you want to have a lot of jokes, you want to be silly, you want to be funny, but I have to say that I think if you squint, or maybe you have like 5 or 6 beers, you have to be able to say, this kind of looks like the movie it's making fun of. You know, Walk Hard is definitely silly, and it has more full frontal male nudity than a normal biopic, but there are parts where you could almost convince yourself, if you were drunk enough, if you were squinting, if you were looking across a room and you couldn't hear it, you could convince yourself, oh, that's a biopic. What biopic is on that TV? Oh, it's Walk Hard. Walk Hard. And I think Black Dynamite, which is my pick, passes that test better than almost any spoof in history. I mean, it really looks, I mean, some people might argue to its detriment, like an old school blaxploitation movie. I mean, they shot it instead of on, you know, digital whatever. They shot it on Super 16. They shot it 16mm. And it really has that grungy, you know, exploitation vibe to it that does not look like a classy production. It looks like an exploitation picture done very cheaply and in haste. And it has a lot of sort of spoofing the really low end of blaxploitation movies. We're not talking about even like a Shaft here, although, you know, Michael Jai White's character, Black Dynamite, certainly has some, you know, resemblances to a character like Shaft. The movie itself is more like a Dolomite. We're talking the real Z-grade blaxploitation movies that were done super cheap and have a lot of kind of gaffes and mistakes. There's a scene where Black Dynamite stands up in a hurry from his seat and the camera kind of, whoops, like kind of pans up and there's a boom mic in the shot, which is something that happens in Black Dynamite. There's a couple of lines that are directly kind of ripped off from, I think it's Disco Godfather, which is another really cheesy but wonderful Rudy Ray Moore blaxploitation film. So it's definitely going for that style, and I think it does it very effectively, and it's just really funny. But it has, I think it also has that kind of deadpan thing. You know, Michael Jai White doesn't tell a lot of jokes here. He just kind of has this very intense character who he's doing, who is so serious that it sort of becomes a goof, because it's the story around him quickly escalates to this very serious
conspiracy,
place.
Yeah,
this enormous conspiracy. It begins when his brother is murdered, and his brother, we eventually learn, is, you know, was like undercover for the CIA, and Black Dynamite, who used to be a CIA agent, decides to work with the CIA to figure out who killed his brother. But of course, there is so much more here than meets the eye, and you do have to kind of admire the insanity that escalates there, and the place that it ultimately ends up with, which
it's,
I have to admit,
so
I did not
good.
See coming.
It's so good.
Is pretty, pretty fabulous. And, you know, the other thing that I admired about this movie, looking at it again, and I hadn't seen it since it came out back in 2009, is the fact that it's almost too close. Like, it's not very PC, which a movie of that time would not be, you know. And there are some scenes, some stuff that he says, that Black Dynamite says, that some other characters say, that kind of, it makes you laugh, but it has that sort of like, ooh, it's a little edgy. And I think that's a good thing, you know, like, because again, you're spoofing this form that was edgy, you know, that was exploitation, that wasn't a safe genre. And I think that there is, again, some kind of purity to Black Dynamite that I really admire and like about it. But that might put some people off. So I guess I'm kind of just putting that out there as a caveat, even though I think it really works.
Black Dynamite!
Never in the history of the game has there been such devastation.
The CIA needs Black Dynamite now more than ever.
We need you, Black Dynamite, now more than ever.
I thought I told you, hunkies from the CIA, that Black Dynamite was out of the game.
And he's better than Shaft, Superfly, and the Mac put together. But when the mob kills his brother,
your death will not go unavenged.
And put the dope on the street.
It's my nephew Bucky. He OD'd.
He's back in the game and he's playing for keeps.
Dynamite! Dynamite! I'm
declaring. So that's Black Dynamite, and you can rent it on Amazon and iTunes.
Joel, Molly, how'd you two meet?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a long story.
Yeah. Oh, we got time. Waiter,
More wine?
Well, it's kind of a corny romantic comedy kind of story.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
Really? How so? Well, Joel's kind of a typical romantic comedy leading man, you know? He's handsome, but in a non-threatening way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Vaguely, but not overtly Jewish.
You're right. Just Jewish enough.
And Molly is the kind of cute, klutzy girl that sometimes will drive you a little bit crazy, but you can't help but fall in love with her.
Guilty.
Okay, so we have our main characters.
Not quite. There was another character that was just as important as the two of us. New York City.
So New York City is like another character.
Time now for our listener's choice review. On every episode of Film Spotting SBU, we give you three choices to vote on, and whichever film or TV show gets the most votes is the one we talk about on the show. And last time they came together was the clear and decisive winner over From Here to Eternity and Like Father, Like Son. It got 46% of the vote versus 33% and 20% for From Here to Eternity and Like Father, Like Son. So it almost had more votes than the other two options combined. So let's get into it. They Came Together. It's the latest comedy from David Wayne, who was one of the core members of the MTV sketch comedy troupe The State. And later he made movie comedies like The 10, Role Models, and the beloved Wet Hot American Summer. They Came Together is in some ways a spiritual sequel to that last film. It reunites many of its cast members, including Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler, along with State alums like Ken Marino and Michael Ian Black. And it sort of looks at romantic comedies the way Wet Hot American Summer looked at summer camp movies. That is to say, with an eye towards observing and then poking fun at all of their most ridiculous cliches. In the film, Rudd and Poehler's characters, Joel and Molly, are out on a double date with another couple, played by Bill Hader and Ellie Kemper. When the conversation turns to the story of how Joel and Molly met, the film flashes back to the origin of their relationship, which will look and sound very familiar to fans of movies like You've Got Mail and Along Came Polly and lots of others, including several classic Woody Allen films. Allison, reviewing comedies can sometimes get a little tricky. A lot of times, it all boils down to the question of, is this funny versus is this not funny? Larger cinematic issues of style and form, technique, theme, they all tend to become secondary, and all that matters and all that anyone talks about are the jokes and the laughs, which, let's be honest, can be very subjective. So, with all of that in mind, my question to you is this funny or is it not funny?
Oh, I think it's funny. I think it's definitely funny. I don't know if I like it more than Wet Hot American Summer, but I should also say that Wet Hot American Summer is a movie that seems to be more funny to me the more I've watched it. And I do have a feeling, this was the second time I took a look at it. I'd already seen it before we got into this. I thought it was more funny as well the second time around. So that may be just something that David Wayne does well. But I think that I actually did an interview with David Wayne for when this movie came out. And something that I thought was particularly telling is that beyond the fact he said that he loves romantic comedies, which I think you have to make a movie like this, because it knows the plot, like all of these little tics and tropes so well, is, you know, he mentioned loving When Harry Met Sally and Woody Allen, but he also said he's a huge fan of, as he put it, like the movies where you don't ever remember the title because it's so generic. And, you know, it's just like two people on the cover. And he said he's a huge fan of like The Proposal. With a Sandra Bullock movie with Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, I couldn't even remember which one that was. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that kind of feeds into this. The vagueness of a lot of those movies is something that this movie captures so well, which is that when you look at a romantic comedy, like just a middle-of-the-line romantic, recent romantic comedy, and look at it just a little sideways, you realize that everyone in it is completely insane, you know? And this, and They Came Together captures that so well by just having its characters have so few defining like qualities. You know, they're so nice and they work in businesses and they have friends who represent different points of view. And, you know, I think that is something that they capture very well here. But Matt, how do you think this works on the scale of spoofs? How would you say this works?
I think it's a good one, and I certainly think it's one of the best we've had recently. But as we said, that's not necessarily the highest form of praise you can get. I did think it works. I will say I agree with you. I don't think it's as good as Wet Hot American Summer, but I also will agree with your caveat that Wet Hot American Summer is a movie that it ages like fine wine. The more you watch it, the more you love it. So I hadn't seen this movie before we were getting ready to discuss it. So when I watched it last night, that was for the first time. So I'm only on one viewing, and I liked it. Now, I could watch it again and like it more and like it more and like it more, and it wouldn't surprise me. On one viewing, the one thing I would say was that while I think it's it knows romantic comedies, and I think there's some really smart humor pointed at demolishing those tropes, I also thought that some of the silliness in it seemed a little out of place, that it didn't really jive with the spoofing, the parody part. The parody part, and then the part that's not necessarily parodying anything specific, but just sort of silly. There are a few sequences that seem like they're in there just to be funny, and God knows there are worse crimes in this world than being funny in a movie, but I just didn't necessarily feel like they meshed all that well. And the example that immediately comes to mind to me is the one where Christopher Maloney, who I think is brilliant and hilarious, has a very long sequence where it's at a Halloween party and he soils himself and covers up the crime. And perhaps that is directly from a romantic comedy that I don't know. But to me, it just felt like a sequence that was there for the sake of the laughs, which were there, which was funny. But it didn't really further the sort of making fun of romantic comedies thing, you know? And I felt like the overall movie could have been a little bit sharper if it had been just a little bit more focused and a little less scattershot.
I would agree, and I that scene is certainly not one of the better ones. And yet, there are other scenes that have nothing to do with romantic comedies that I think are some of the funniest ones, like a bit in which Paul Rudd's character goes into a bar and has this circular conversation with the bartender that is allowed to like go on
yes.
for like much longer than you think it would. And
yes.
it's really great.
It's brilliant.
It's really fantastic.
But yes. I would say this.
Yes.
Is that scene is in almost every romantic comedy where one of the characters is sad and gets counsel from the wise bartender. So in a sense, even though that scene is absurd and it goes to such an extreme place, I feel like it is making fun of something in a romantic comedy.
I suppose so. If it had anything to do with him receiving wisdom, feel like the fact that he goes into the bar, which is agreed, like a very typical romantic comedy scene, and yet what he gets there has nothing to do with what those scenes are like in a romantic
comedy.
Fair enough. It is just absurdity and a part that I really like. I do think in some ways the kind of bigger like satirical spoofs the bits about like Amy Poehler's character is like, you know, great in all ways, but klutzy is a little, I mean, it's absolutely dead on. And Mindy Kaling has written about this before in a really funny piece she has in The New Yorker, which is worth looking up as well. But like that is almost less funny to me than it's the little bits that I think they call out very well, which is like bad screenwriting tropes, which they like clearly Michael Showalter, who co-wrote this, and David Wayne love. Things like when Paul Rudd goes in to meet his best friend, he's like, "Hey, best friend." And in the same way, when he talks to his little brother's like, "Big brother, why do you have to?" And he calls him little brother. Like things
right.
that no normal human being
right.
would ever do.
Things that are, and bad screenplays are shorthand so that they're trying to muscle in exposition.
Right.
And trying to do it subtly. But they're always doing it clunkily, and here they're making fun of that. And that's something I picked up on, too. I think there's one part, it's the scene where they're going to visit her parents, which is another very good scene. And they're like, "I'm so glad you're able to come along with me on this trip up to the country to visit my parents."
Yes.
And it's just like, I agree. I thought that sort of stuff was great. And that's another great scene, too, is the dinner scene, which is very kind of in the mode of like an Annie Hall, the dinner scene, and has a great punchline, too, as well.
Yes. I think that in some ways it's like the more generic things that or the little off bits that I really liked, like Paul Rudd's apartment, which is an
yes.
amazing bit of set design.
Yes.
Because it is the most terribly generic like dude apartment you can imagine. This
right.
cavernous space.
Huge.
Because, of course, in any movie set in New York, it's everyone always has impossible apartments.
Right.
And it has like pinball machine in the corner.
Yep.
It has like
clocks on the walls.
Yeah, three clocks on one wall.
Yeah.
A stop sign or something from like a street sign on the other wall. Like leather couches and just it's and a globe, I think. It's just the like it's like some, you know, set designer was like, "This might be what a man would like. I've never been to New York or met a man, but it's pretty great." And I think like those little bits are stronger in some ways than when it clearly tries to to pick at something like, here is what a romantic comedy lead is like.
Right.
You know?
I agree with you. There are fine touches here that are in some ways more sublime than the big jokes that people are going to quote and remember. I mean, even just in the beginning of the movie, you have to be paying attention, which is one thing I love about spoofs. You can't watch a spoof, a good spoof, distracted. You can't be on your phone. You can't be talking to someone. You have to be watching because there'll be jokes in the background. There'll be jokes in, you know, away from the conversations. There'll be physical gags. And just in the very beginning of the movie, the very first scene, they're in that restaurant, they're talking. And right as they cut away from Paul Rudd after he says something, he's drinking wine. And he puts his mouth, he tries to, like, put the entire wine glass in his mouth. And it's maybe five frames. You have to be watching. But it's just stuff like that, which I just love, too, because it's rewarding you for being attentive, which is something that, you know, a lot of these romantic comedies, real romantic comedies, are designed to be watched, like, out of the corner of your eye on an airplane, like on a date where you're more interested in the date than the screen. You know, like, it's just I found that part of it very refreshing as well. And yeah. I think we should also talk a little bit, because we haven't really mentioned them very much at all so far, about Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd and how great they are in this and how great they are together. And what it was making me think of watching them was how unfunny people in romantic comedies, the actors in romantic comedies, are.
Like, romantic comedies are supposed to be funny. They have comedy in them.
Right, exactly. Yes. And that's what this movie was really making me think about on, like, a deeper level, was how unfunny romantic comedies are and how unfunny the people in romantic comedies are. They're usually very attractive. They could sometimes be cute. They might have, you know,
they're never given distinguishing characteristics, which is part of how someone becomes funny. Right.
And even if they tell jokes, they're people, it's like unfunny people telling jokes, you know, and here you have two brilliantly funny people. And it made me go, why can't, as much as I enjoyed this, I was like, why can't we have a regular, you know, non-spoofy romantic comedy starring Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler? And wouldn't that be an amazing movie? And wouldn't that be fun? And I mean, hey, there's no reason that couldn't happen someday. But that was something that I was really thinking about watching this, was I would love to see Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd in a straight romantic comedy.
Yes. Yeah. And certainly Paul Rudd has made a fair amount of indistinguishable romantic comedies.
Not that many. I mean, some.
I mean, I think if you went back and looked at his filmography, he's made like a handful, probably. But either way, they're not ones that anyone remembers. I agree. I would love to see them together. There's another, this is barely related to what we're talking about, but one of the other jokes that I like the most in this is when they're initially bonding and falling in love, and they bond over a mutual like of fiction books,
right,
which is as specific as anything is willing to get. And I think the kind of weird, like, anti-chemistry, I guess, that Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler have in this scene, in which they're supposed to instantly have this deep rapport,
right,
over
after hating each other when they meet each other,
yes, over like ordering coffee and liking fiction books.
Yes.
I think it does make you kind of wish that they had like a straightforward film in which they played actual characters,
right,
and could fall in love.
One other thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap it up, and this is a thing that I sort of liked and also kind of, I don't want to say disliked, but it raised some issues with me, and that's this, is the cast of the film, which is stacked. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from up to the top, with the big characters are all great comedic actors, down to some roles that have three or four lines, you'll go, wow, this person is in this movie. And I don't even want to list them because I kind of don't want to spoil it. But, you know, we mentioned already Bill Hader is in there, and Ellie Kemper, and Jason Mantzoukas plays Paul Rudd's best friend, and he is great. Melanie Lynskey is his wife. She's funny. Ed Helms has a pretty substantial role.
Yeah, and he's very funny.
Michael Ian Black, I think I mentioned, is in there. And on and on down the line. And there are some cameos, which I won't spoil at all, where people pop up for a scene, a line, no dialogue at all. And those are amazing, too. But here was my question. Is traditionally in the classical spoof, your Airplanes, your Blazing Saddles, that sort of world, you often have comedians in the foreground, but you'll often have those films filled out by kind of people kind of poking fun at themselves, you know, and that adds something. It's like the incongruity of seeing a Robert Stack telling jokes or being so self-serious that it enhances the comedy in some ways. And this movie doesn't have that. Did that bother you at all?
I mean, it definitely made me aware of how many famous friends David Wayne has.
Right.
And I think that was the primary thing that came from it, is that there are times when... I won't mention who it is, but there was a cameo towards the end when there's like the big finish in which, yes, many different characters come out. There, like, one character who we've never met before comes out, and or a few of them. Like, there's one in particular that's like very funny. This guy is like really funny, and I'm really happy to have him in the movie. But it's very distracting that it's exactly like the character that, like, it's that person. I was,
right,
so aware of who it was, and even like the mechanics of getting him to come and show up. And I think like it certainly interferes a little bit.
Mm. But to me, I was of two minds about this. I hope I'm conveying this, how I was sort of conflicted. It's like, on the one hand, I would have loved to have seen a They Came Together with a couple of the actors that you see in these kind of movies who aren't all that funny. You know, there, I think, again, I don't want to name any names either, but I feel like we could probably name a few who would strike us as the sort of actors or actresses we see in these movies as some of these types, you know, the stereotypes. And that could have really added a little bit of bite to it. On the other hand, again, it gets back to the idea that a romantic comedy is supposed to be funny. And isn't it kind of wonderful that here is a romantic comedy that actually is funny and has all these really genuinely funny people in all these roles? I guess, to me, ultimately, that was the side that I came down on, although it was something I thought about a lot.
One more thing before we wrap this up.
Sure.
Which is the thing that they say in the very beginning and repeatedly throughout the film, and it's even on the poster in tiny little red type at the bottom.
Yes.
Which is...
I referenced it at the top,
yes,
of the podcast,
yes,
as well.
New York. It's practically a character.
It's
its own character, yeah, in the movie. Did you think that the movie's treatment of that kind of that stereotype, did it work for you? Or do you feel like it was too much of a kind of like New York person joke? I feel like sometimes when someone, like when Paul Rudd says, for me, a vacation is like getting a cheese Danish at Zabar's and reading the Sunday Times or something like that. Like, that was initially funny, but I don't know. Some of the other vagueness of New York jokes kind of felt a little insidey to me.
It worked for me mostly. I thought it was, I mean, it's really making fun of film critics more than anything else, because it's critics who are the ones who always write about how New York is almost another character in the movie. So, and I have written that? Probably. If I do a Google search on my name, I bet I could find a review where I mentioned something like that. And hey, you know, if we're making fun of movie cliches, make fun of the film critic cliches too. It certainly is a cliche. It's certainly worth making fun of. I mean, to me, it looked like they didn't shoot all of it in New York. It seemed like some scenes seemed like they were backlots. And sometimes there's a deliberate backlot,
yeah,
shot that's really funny involving a trip to another city, which I won't spoil. But like, for example, the scene, which is a great scene where they're kind of looking out the window of like a coffee shop. They're clearly not. I mean, the New York, the subway stop across the street says like Upper West Side subway stop or something like that. And it's clearly not a real New York City street. So I don't know. Was that designed to make fun of the fact that these movies that claim a New Yorkerness, an authenticity about New York, often aren't entirely shot in New York? They're shot in Toronto or something, and then they come here for a week and pretend that they're very authentic? Or was that just a matter of expediency and budget? I'm not sure. You could probably argue both ways.
I think I don't know. I think it definitely wants to make fun of, as you said, that the idea of these movies often picking up the most vague basic details about a city and using it,
right,
for to create like a supposed sense of authenticity.
Right. I mean, there's not a lot of shots where you can definitively say, oh, they're really in New York right now. I mean, the ending is shot right across, you know, by the Brooklyn Promenade. That's, you know, that's legit. But there's also some stuff that's just kind of like, yeah, it looks like backlot stuff. Maybe it would have been funnier. This might be more, you know, Here's me telling David Wayne how to be funny. I think I know what I'm doing here. But I feel like the Zucker Brothers version would have been to have all those New York jokes and then have them be demonstratively have been in Los Angeles or shown the back lot,
yeah,
or shown the, you know, like have the Sears Tower in the background or something. Probably would have been the way to really make it a silly joke, which is, I mean, this movie is pretty silly, though. There are some very silly moments, and I liked it. Overall, I think it's really funny. And I am looking forward to seeing it again and seeing if, like Wet Hot American Summer, it becomes one of those movies that does enhance on multiple viewings.
Yeah, for me it is. And so that is They Came Together. It is currently available for rent and on demand.
All right, let's wrap things up with our Behind the Eight Ball segment. You know how this goes. We give you three new titles, two listener recommendations, and one random film from our My Lists. And each of us goes, give you a little countdown, give you some more movies to watch, and then we hit the road. Allison, you're going to be going first this week. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, so let's start with three films that are new to streaming.
Okay, first up is The Immigrant, which is new to Netflix, the latest film from James Gray, starring a really excellent Marion Cotillard as a Polish woman who arrives in New York, only to find her sister quarantined for TB, and the uncle who's supposed to collect her is not there, and she ends up in the clutches of a shyster played by Joaquin Phoenix, who runs a shady theater in the area. And I think what's so great about this film is the way in which Cotillard's character, for all that she is a relative innocent, is more aware of the ways in which she's being victimized than, say, Phoenix's character, or that of Jeremy Renner, who plays a magician who turns out to have ties to Phoenix's character. The two men both create these kind of more heroic or delusional excuses for what is essentially kind of more self-motivated behavior. It's really a great tragedy and drama. And it, if you didn't get a chance to see it in theaters, which I don't think most people did, it is now available on Netflix to check out. Also new to Netflix, another great Joaquin Phoenix performance in The Master. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, Inherent Vice, was just announced as the centerpiece of the New York Film Festival. But you can now watch his last one on Netflix. You know, I think this is really the role of a lifetime so far for Phoenix, and also features a pretty stunning turn from the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman as the leader of an organization not unlike Scientology. And finally, new to Hulu is Tetsuo the Bullet Man. This is the third film in Shinya Tsukamoto's kind of cyberpunk slash body horror series, which started with cult favorite and the best of a lot, certainly, Tetsuo the Iron Man in 1989, and was followed up with Tetsuo 2 Body Hammer in 1992. 17 years later, in 2009, Tsukamoto returns to his idea of a businessman who begins growing metal things and guns out of his body, this time in English and featuring some music by Trent Reznor. I will go ahead and say this is the worst of the three, certainly, but it's still a new Tetsuo film and is interesting to see kind of what time has done or has not done in terms of for Tsukamoto's treatment of the character, or the two characters really, who always end up dueling in the series, which is never, it's not a continuing story. It's always just a new variation on the theme.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, first up, we have a rec from Alexis from Medford, Oregon, who writes, hey, longtime listener, haven't emailed in a while. I don't know if anyone has suggested Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. It is an Australian import streaming on Netflix. Fun hour-long mysteries. She's smart and has heart and is a total flirt. And then we have another recommendation from Graham from Manchester, who actually wrote in earlier. This film wasn't available here yet, but is now available on Netflix. He writes, I'd like to recommend Free Fall, a rather excellent German film from 2013. Mark seems to have a pretty nice life, moving into a new house with his pregnant girlfriend, a promising career in the police, and all this is thrown into turmoil when he meets Kay at the police academy. Hidden desires stir, and he embarks on a passionate affair with him. Hanno Kofler does well with the thankless, unsympathetic role of Mark. It's a very honest portrayal of turmoil and confusion. Indeed, the two very handsome lead actors have a great chemistry, and a super steamy affair is well played out. So that is Free Fall. It's currently on Netflix.
Okay, and one film chosen from your My List.
You gave me number 77, which is Twilight, the first film in the series. Not really sure why it's on the list, as I... not afraid to say this, I have seen Twilight. I have seen the whole Twilight series. But those are the mysteries of the My List.
I think we all know why it's on there, Allison. Let's be honest.
Okay, if it's on there for repeat reasons, as you're saying, why is it number 77, Matt? Why is it not number one?
Well, you have your priorities aren't that out of whack. You have other things to watch first, but...
yeah, I'm not convinced by this explanation of the mystery.
You literally don't even remember putting it on there? You have no idea how it got on there?
I mean, I must have put it on there, but I've certainly... seen it.
Do you get like blackout drunk and watch and Twilight
add,
sometimes?
Or just add it, Twilight add it without not watching it?
That looks good. Why not?
Apparently. All right, Matt. It's
sounds
your
like
turn.
You. I mean, it sounds like
it
something
sounds,
you would
yeah,
do.
Yeah, it does. It sounds
doesn't
like
doesn't seem
me.
Out of character.
I mean, I'm very consistent in my taste, even apparently while blackout drunk. All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, three new releases.
Okay, first up is a crowd-pleasing documentary that premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival, where it was acquired by Netflix, and it's called The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which I'm realizing, as I'm saying this, that it's going to be an impossible title to say out loud. It follows an independent minor league baseball team called the Portland Mavericks. They were founded in 1973 by actor Bing Russell, who is the father of Kurt Russell, who actually played a little bit for the Mavs and appears as a talking head in the film. And the Mavericks are basically a grown-up version of the Bad News Bears. There's this shaggy gang of misfits. They've all been discarded or ignored by the major leagues, by the establishment in baseball, but they still became really good together. They had this very gritty style of play, and they quickly became the best team in the Northwest League. They were shattering attendance records in Portland, and then they became the victims of their own success. And that's sort of what the film is about. And I think the movie could have used a little more context. The movie features some interviews with players from the team, and Kurt Russell is in there. Kurt Russell's mother is a subject. And some sports writers from Portland are interviewed as well. But I think you could have used a little bit more of just the background about, there's a lot about like the establishment in baseball and the baseball establishment that I think it would have helped maybe a little to know just a little bit about who that was and have someone who represented that worldview maybe appear, or at least a historian who could speak to that. I didn't really feel like I fully understood what that meant, even though I'm a baseball fan and I get the idea. I just wanted a little bit more of that perspective. That said, I mean, I already mentioned the Bad News Bears. It is kind of like a real world Bad News Bears. It's an underdog sports story. It's a fun documentary. It's a really entertaining and well made film. It's only like 80 minutes, so it's a quick watch, and I recommend it. That's The Battered Bastards of Baseball, streaming on Netflix. Also available now on Netflix is one of the sharper no-budget horror movies I've seen in the last few years. It came and went. I saw it at Fantastic Fest in, I think, 2012. I'm not really sure why it didn't seem to go anywhere, because I really like this movie. I'm not sure if you saw it, Allison. It's called The Conspiracy. Played at Fantastic Fest. It's a found footage thriller about a bunch of guys who are supposedly making a documentary about a conspiracy theorist, and then he disappears. And so they keep investigating these two guys who are supposedly documentarians, and they find his, I know you love this cliche, Allison, the wall, the conspiracy
My
wall,
favorite.
The crazy yet
Does
artful
it have some yarn.
It has yarn,
yes.
I believe, yarn and news clippings. And so they find his wall, his crazy wall, and they kind of keep investigating this group called the Taurus Club. They're the secret society that supposedly controls the world. And it's a good, I mean, I do like found footage movies. I know some people don't. I think this is a really good one. It has a really good, sharp faux documentary style. The ending, which is mostly done with like hidden cameras in air quotes, is really good. And I like the ending of this movie a lot. It's a really nice twist on separating fact and fiction and conspiracy theories. And it's there's no stars, low budget movie, but really well made. I'm not really sure why it never went anywhere, but I was glad to see that it popped up on Netflix. That's The Conspiracy. And last but not least, one quick update. We've talked before on the podcast about The Act of Killing, the incredible documentary from Joshua Oppenheimer about Indonesian gangsters who participated in this coup decades earlier. They killed thousands of people, but because they and their allies are still in power, they were never brought to justice. And it's an incredible film. And I just thought we should mention that there's a director's cut of the film that's 45 minutes longer than the original version that played in theaters. And that was just added to Netflix. They actually have both versions. They have the original version and now also the director's cut. So if you like the film, you're interested in seeing more, you can check out the director's cut. If you've never seen either version, you know, you could start with the theatrical cut, which is stunning, and then move on to the director's cut. But either way, if you haven't seen it, you should absolutely check it out.
All right, two listener recommendations.
All right, our first one comes from a listener named Beck. Just gave us a whole list of stuff which is available on Netflix. Philadelphia, Crimson Tide, Witness, a lot of 90s, Seems Like Old Times, and also echoing your recommendation, Allison, The Immigrant. That was a whole list of rapid-fire recommendations. And second, we've got a recommendation here from James in Chicago. He recommends Zodiac, which is streaming now on Netflix. He says, this is one of my favorite cop films of the last few years, with Mark Ruffalo, Jake Gyllenhaal, and especially Robert Downey Jr., all giving great performances, although this movie sort of got overshadowed when it came out by other great films like No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. This is the movie from 2007 that has stuck with me the most and which I have rewatched the most. I just saw it again, and it holds up really well. So that is Zodiac, streaming on Netflix.
All right, and one from your My List.
You gave me number 50, and it is not a film. It is a TV show. It is The X-Files, which I did not watch, even though I had a lot of friends as a nerd growing up in the mid to late 90s that watched that show. I never really got into it, and I added it to Netflix when my list on Netflix when I saw it was added to Netflix. And actually, I think last year, maybe around this time, one night when I didn't have anything to watch, I started The X-Files. And over the course of the week, I watched like the first three or four episodes, and I thought they were good. But it's just the kind of thing where I'm busy. I'm busy. Well, okay. I'll be honest. I wanted you to be honest. I'll be honest. I'm not busy. But I'm watching a lot of movies when I'm not busy, and I don't have a lot of time to watch TV shows, especially ones that are, you know, over, that are not quite as culturally relevant as other things. I feel like there are other things that I should be catching up with. So, you know, I bet if I watched it, I would really like it. At least I've heard that it tails off at the end. But I've heard that, you know, the first couple, seasons are
really,
really
good. I was a big fan.
Yeah, so, well, I'll have to try to make some more time for The X-Files. Let's get to our listener's choice options for our next episode. We've got three pretty good ones here. I have seen one of them. You have seen one of them?
Yes.
But not the same one.
No, different ones.
Different ones. The first option, though, neither of us has seen.
That's correct.
And it is an intriguing-looking film named The Congress, which is available for rental on iTunes and also on VOD. It's directed by Ari Folman, who was the director of the superb animated film Waltz with Bashir. I believe this film has animated and live-action elements, and it's based on a novel by Stanislav Lem, who wrote Solaris, the original novel Solaris. So quite a pedigree here. It's a science fiction film. I'll read you the description here from IMDb. It says, an aging, out-of-work actress, that's Robin Wright, accepts one last job, though the consequences of her decision affect her in ways she didn't consider. And that is Robin Wright, who we love on House of Cards. She's the star here. And without giving away too much more, it involves, like, digital avatars. I think you mentioned that earlier in the show, at the top of the show during opening break. It's like this job where basically her digital avatar could potentially be used forever in other films, like without her. So the sort of moral and perhaps artistic implications of that idea.
Yeah, and I think certainly timely when we're seeing more and more sometimes late actors being resurrected digitally, sometimes to hawk products.
Absolutely, yes, to dance with vacuum cleaners,
right.
Or sell. Audrey Hepburn was in?
Yes,
something
lately. I don't remember.
She might have
was.
Been selling like chocolate or something.
Yeah, it's something very. There's something very odd about it.
There is something very odd about it, and you're right. It makes this idea very timely and very interesting. It's something we're both looking forward to seeing. So that's The Congress. You can rent it online or you can watch it on VOD.
All right, next up is a film that I recently saw and enjoyed a lot. And I know, Matt, you've been looking forward to it. It is The Raid 2, which is available for rent and on VOD. The second film from Gareth Evans, who pairs once again with the star of the first The Raid, Iko Uwais. It's once again set in Indonesia and picks up like 2 hours after the first Raid starts. And, you know, the first...
No rest for the weary
no,
for this
absolutely
poor guy.
Not. The first Raid is this very deliberately contained but intense action movie all set within this apartment block that the police are raiding. The second film picks up with the Iko Uwais' character as he's basically brought into this division where he's asked to go undercover, and kind of it's suggested that he has no real choice in doing this because the what happened in the first raid has made his family vulnerable, and he has to kind of go finish this. And it becomes this big sprawling crime epic with a lot of crazy action sequences that Evans directs so well, and that became a signature in the first The Raid and made it a kind of breakout. So I would certainly be happy to watch it again. That's The Raid 2.
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah. Looking forward to it. Haven't had a chance to. So for me, it would just be a really good excuse to watch it, because that's the thing. I missed the screenings when it came out, and now it's like I don't have a reason to watch it other than I just want to watch Iko Uwais, you know, kick people in the face. So this would be a good excuse to do that.
Yep. The Raid 2, and it's on iTunes and VOD.
Okay, and our last pick is a Netflix option, and it is an older title, and it is a film I've seen, although only once, maybe twice, not in a long time. Allison's never seen it.
I have not seen it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's Manhunter, written and directed by Michael Mann, based on the novel by Thomas Harris. That novel, of course, is Red Dragon, and much of this material is now the basis for a TV show, a very popular, well, not maybe, popular-ish TV show, critically acclaimed TV show anyway, Hannibal, that's on right now on, is it NBC? Is
that yes.
And I've seen some of that. It's a good show.
It's a really good show.
It's a really beautiful show.
It is one of the most disturbing shows in terms of violence. It's some of the most disturbing violence I can think of.
Yes. And it's on network television,
which
is really
nuts.
Really crazy. But it's a good show. And of course, there was another movie version based on the novel by Brett Ratner, Red Dragon. It came out later. This is the original one. This is the first Hannibal Lecter movie. It does not have Anthony Hopkins. It has Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter. It also has William Peterson from later from CSI. He plays Will Graham. And actually, Dennis Farina is Jack Crawford. So you have a lot of these characters you recognize and a lot of actors you recognize. But it's like they've been
remixed.
Yeah, remixed. Exactly. And it's a very good film. It's one of Michael Mann's great 80s movies.
And I think, you know, it'd be interesting to have just kind of a talk, use it as a place to have a talk about the Hannibal Lecter series and these incarnations that it's had.
Yeah, we could conceivably just do a show about Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
I mean, I think just the fact that he kind of goes from this disturbing character to kind of an anti-hero, I think there's a lot there to talk about.
Absolutely. So that's Manhunter, option 3, available on Netflix.
So which of these movies should we review in the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com, which is what most people do. Your vote must be received by Monday, July 28th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is at FilmSpottingSVU, and you will have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on Tuesday, August 5th.
FilmSpottingSVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The FilmSpottingSVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of his work at vincevandal.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, though, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer, and you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. And don't forget to keep sending us. Send. We want to know what you guys are watching. It's so hard finding recommendations of our own. Tell us what you're watching. We are curious. We genuinely want to know. We genuinely want to share it. Email what you've been watching, what you've been streaming, to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. And for Film Spotting SVU, I am Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.